From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack. We're diving right into today's podcast because it was a heavy week on the show with conversations about racism, suicide, and a mass shooting. They're all important conversations, and we had some very emotional moments with our guests in the studio and with our listeners on the phone and via social media. We'll start with a conversation about a new documentary called Move. It's a project by first-time filmmaker Tam Little, and it explores the aftermath of the 2015 mass shooting at the Boys and Girls Club in Rochester. Raekwon Manigault, Jonah Barley, and Johnny J.R. Johnson were killed. In this clip, you'll hear Lentori Johnson talk about her son, J.R. He had finally gotten a full-time job, and he took his children out to celebrate. Here's Lentori talking about JR's legacy as a father and her thoughts on gun culture in America.
You know, much is said in our community a lot of time about absentee father. Well, let me assert to you, JR was never an absentee father. Never.
You said in the film that his loss impacts those kids still all the time.
It does. He was their Superman. He would come home and once J.R. walked in that door, the whole house would just be full of noise and laughter and joy because he'd take them and fly them around the house, set them on top of the refrigerator, all in your way while you're trying to cook dinner, you know. And they would squeal and holler, "Daddy, Grandma, tell Daddy, get me down, get me down." And as soon as he would take them down after I would, you know, protest and beg him to take them down, Daddy put me back, Daddy put me back. And you're trying to do dinner at the same time. And one of the best things I can tell people about is he finally got a job. Finally got a job he thought they would afford him the ability to provide for his children the way he wanted to provide for them. First paycheck he got that Saturday, we went shopping. He tried to spend every dime on them. And he was working what he called his piece of job and his final good job. And he told them that Saturday when we were out, I won't forget, he said, "Next check Daddy get, you can have it all. We'll do this again." Well, that was Saturday. He quit the job, the part-time, on Monday. And on Wednesday, my child was gone. Their father was gone. And they went through counseling, and that just stopped in recent times. There's times when they still cry, and we kind of hold each other up because they know sometimes Grandma's sad. And so they'll say to me, "Grandma, you sad because you miss Daddy?" And I tell them, "Yes." And they said, "Me too." And so I recognize the fact that it's going to be important, as been shared with me through the counselor, to continue to counseling at different stages of their life. Because, see, he won't be there for many things a father should be there for and he would have wanted to be there for. He won't be there as he did in times past. When Jemiah graduated from pre-K to kindergarten, he won't be there when they graduate from high school. He won't be there when they take a vow with someone they may come to love as he did their mother. He won't be there for his grandchildren as I have been for mine. And I'll tell you, that would have meant the world to him. We have the NRA who doesn't even want to attempt to look at common sense approaches that would probably help to limit. Guns are not going away. They're never going away. But for us not to have a conversation, for us to not have insight into how corrupt the gun community has become and them not valuing our life, and I want to be more specific than that, not valuing the lives of individuals in the brown and black community, I hate that. I hate that with a passion. I really do. Because, see, I'm looking at the fact. And sometimes I have to get off the computer and sometimes I got to push away from some of the groups. That, here's the deal. Lord knows, you got people who want these guns and some of them have amassed arsenals. Now, you need that much protection, in quote unquote, for protection of yourself and your family. But yet you can leave your home. And when you leave your home, who is protecting that armory that you build up and have left behind? It's no coincidence that these guns are coming into our community. And people can fool themselves all they want. It's not. The only variance is in the urban communities, there's mostly homicides. In the suburban communities, if guns are accessible, there's suicide. That's the only variation that's happening in this. But our children, they're dying in mass. And you know what? Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Let me say that to you. Because often, they don't talk about our children. And when I say our children, I mean in the brown and the black community. Here today, gone tomorrow. But J.R. was not an imagination to me.
You can see the film, again, it's called Move, at the Little Theater at 7 p.m. on December 12th and December 15th. Next, a look at racism in schools. African American families are the fastest growing demographic in the homeschooling movement, with black students now making up about 10% of the homeschool population. That's according to several organizations that track educational trends. Researchers say black parents are deciding to homeschool their children to avoid institutional racism. In this clip, you'll hear Eileen Graham, a local mother who pulled her daughter out of the public school system last year. But first, here's a caller named Sue. She decided to homeschool her young, white daughter after they noticed that the students of color in her daughter's class were being treated differently than the white students.
We homeschool our kids. We are not an African-American family, but originally, my partner and I are both teachers, and we had chosen to have our kids go to city schools because we thought that it would be a great thing for them to go to a school where it's more racially and ethnically and culturally diverse. But we received a wake-up call when our kindergartner came home from a school and said to us, the brown kids are the ones who are bad, and the only good kids in the class are me, and she named the only other white kid in her class. And that shocked us so much that I started volunteering with the school, and what I saw was, okay, I kind of understand why this little five-year-old got this message, because what she saw was the African-American kids being treated differently, and even a five-year-old could see it, than she was treated in our city schools. And so I just wanted to say that I completely understand and support why African-American families would not want their kids to be going to a school in which that was the subtext and the message that kids were taking home. I was frankly appalled, and I'm a certified elementary teacher, and I've worked in the city. I was appalled when I went into my daughter's classroom and saw the difference. It was so evident in how this white teacher, older white female teacher, differentiated between the kids. And when I saw that, and I thought, if I want to raise a child with healthy attitudes about race and about cultural differences, this is not going to be the venue to do that. There were other reasons why we chose to homeschool, but it was a little shocking. It was more than a little shocking. And I feel like as a homeschooler, we intermingle with families with so many differences and so many different things to bring to the table that it's really so much more beneficial to us and healthy, I think.
Thank you, Sue, for the phone call. Go ahead. Let's let our panel respond. Go ahead.
I'm really happy that Sue brought that up because I can think of three toxic, really, relationships that I added to my list. You know, homework, the dynamic of, you know, my advocacy, you know, like a white mom could come in and demand something. I come in and I'm the angry black parent. You know, just really wanting to understand what's happening. You know, what is Common Core? What does that look like? Because it had gotten to the point where I didn't understand how to help my daughter. And the school started in September. By the end of October, her teacher was saying, I want to refer her out with nothing to support her decision. And so, you know, while I'm trying to be diplomatic and work with the teacher, it still became a power struggle And it was no longer about my daughter. And so I think that those toxic relationships cannot be the reason why you homeschool, but you have to make a decision to make sure that you're doing what's best for your child.
Eileen, I want to follow up, and we'll let everyone jump in on this because I think that was a very powerful phone call. But Eileen, when you mentioned something, this is something that I'll never have to deal with. If I advocate for my son, I will be viewed as a strong advocate. If black families advocate, sometimes you get labeled, especially black women. Mm-hmm. Daniel Ponder has made that point on this program on two separate occasions.
Wow.
That you have to almost check yourself and think about, well, am I going to become, will I come off as angry or crazy or whatever the stereotype may be? What is that like for you, Eileen? Are you someone who says, I don't care what they think, I'm going to advocate, or do you think I have to soften this? How do you approach that?
It's a little demoralizing on the activist end, but it's a little frustrating because as a parent, I understand that we're supposed to work together, but I'm a taxpayer as well. So I try not to bring in all those dynamics because I really want to collaborate. I really would like to work with the teacher, not necessarily as an expert, but as a partner. So if we have a partnership and a relationship and we're doing what's best, we don't even really have to like each other or our communication style or, I might have locks, you may have, green hair, whatever it is. I'm coming in doing what's best for my child. If you can't get past my race and what I look like and how I communicate, then that's your problem. We can never get to what's best for our children. And my relationship and my experiences with the RCSD has not always been great because of my advocacy. And every brick wall that I run into, I'm bringing people back to understand that I'm advocating for my daughter. This is not about me or you.
As more women are speaking out about sexual harassment and sexual assault in the workplace and beyond, women in the media industry, specifically those in television news, are sharing their stories of how they've been harassed by viewers. Anchors and reporters say that the comments they receive about their appearances and personalities are offensive, disgusting, and racist. A video of a newscast in Atlanta went viral earlier this week after an anchor named Sharon Reed reprimanded a viewer on the air after that viewer used a racial epithet in an email. Casey Jones is a reporter at WHEC in Rochester. She's African American, and in this clip, you'll hear her reaction to that story, and she shares her own experiences of harassment on the job at a different station in Texas.
I think that what Sharon Reed said was very necessary. She had such a point. It's 2017 and you're still calling me the N-word, so obviously race is still an issue. And I think she got her point across. And I'm sure Kathy Ray, who I think people discovered doesn't even live in Atlanta, I think she lives in Flint, Michigan, I'm sure she ate her words and hopefully she understood that she was all wrong for what she did. And unfortunately, like you say, journalists of color, women of color, have to experience things like that all the time. I am originally from Richmond, Virginia, which is the capital of the Confederacy, but I never really experienced racism. I went to a historically black college, university, and my first job was out in West Texas. And taking me from an HBCU where everyone looks like me to a place like West Texas where nobody looks like me was completely different, but totally necessary. And I think there was definitely a reason that was my first job ever. Because again, I hadn't really experienced much of it. First time I was called an N-word was on air. I mean, someone wrote in and said, you have this new N-word girl on air. First couple of days I had been there. So it kind of let me know what I was in for. Stayed there a year and a half. But one of the situations that I can remember very, very clearly is I was an MMJ, which means that I do everything by myself. I shoot, edit, write, and sometimes I even have to run my own live shots by myself. So as I'm out middle of nowhere, a place called Andrews, Texas, I am about to go live on air, and these two white men come in a pickup truck, and they're circling the area that I'm in with a Confederate flag hanging on the back of their truck, just riding in circles, just going and going and going, honking the horn, keep in mind, I mean, I got to be composed to be on air in just a few minutes. I'm just standing there by myself. So it's a question of, you know, my safety. Then I'm also, you know, looking at them with the Confederate flag. Like, I mean, what are you trying to say? Obviously, we know the history of the Confederate flag. And it was just, it was a lot to handle. And again, I think that was supposed to be my first job for a reason, because here in Rochester, thankfully, I haven't experienced anything like that. But from that Confederate flag incident to people posting pictures of monkeys under my stories to people just calling me the N-word under the stories, sometimes it would hurt even more because it would be posted on Facebook, of course. And we had someone who monitored our Facebook page, but somehow those comments got overlooked and I had to remove them myself. So it was just a lot to deal with. And I think Sharon Reed, hats off to her for being able to respond to something like that. I wasn't always given the opportunity to respond. And mm-hmm. I knew that even if I did respond, would I really have been able to change anyone's mind? I always thought the best thing in that situation when someone is just overtly racist is to just prove them wrong, prove to them that I'm human, just like they're human, and maybe we can relate on some level.
We'll close the week with a conversation about loss, specifically about people who lose their siblings to suicide. The Sibling Survivors of Suicide Loss Group says about 25,000 people each year become sibling survivors of suicide, and they can experience thoughts of taking their own lives. Patrick Scahill is the chairman of Superfly Corp. It's a nonprofit he founded in memory of his brother, Martin. In this clip, he shares how he learned about Martin's death and how suicide has touched his family more than once.
My brother was a sergeant in the Marine Corps in California and got a call the day after Easter in 2010 that Martin had taken his own life. We knew things had kind of gotten a little haywire for the months leading up to that, drinking more, sounding a little bit more angry about life, tried to make a few phone calls, but they went unanswered. I think for my family, when we're talking about bereavement, counseling, stuff like that, I come from a family where my grandmother committed suicide in the 70s, my father committed suicide in 2004, my brother committed suicide in 2010, I had a cousin commit suicide just a few years ago. So this is something that is a part of, I don't want to say it's a part of the family, but it's something that we are used to in a sad sort of way. So I think it's a little bit more difficult sometimes. It just trying to understand, especially when you have so many people around you, not think that they're loved.
I don't know how to even ask this, but I just ache for your family, thinking about that family history. You lost your dad to suicide when?
In 2004.
And then your brother in 2010?
Yes, sir.
I mean, does it feel in 2010 like, not again, I can't believe this? I mean, I am so sorry.
When it comes as a shock, when you wake up and you are told that you can no longer hold that person, love that person, laugh with that person, because they decided something, that's what hurts the most. That there is no closure. And I think that's one of the things about suicide that's so difficult for people like us right now, the siblings, is that there is no closure. There's so many things left questioned. There's so many things left unanswered that you can't. People get mad. People get angry. People want to blame. People just hate, shut off. They do whatever they want to do. But I think one of the things that we've tried to do here is move past and try to create memories, because that's all we have of them. That's it.
This is according to Dr. David Brent, a psychiatrist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. A first-degree relative, that is, including siblings, of a person who has committed suicide is 4 to 6 times more likely to attempt suicide. And does your family talk about that at this point? I mean, do you worry about getting another call in the future of this nature, or do you find a way not to have that consume your thoughts?
When it comes to my immediate, so I'll speak just on my immediate family. My family is very large. My brother and I talk about it. My mother and I talk about it. I speak with my children who are 10 and 12 years old. They know about it. They don't know the finite details, but they know it happens. And they know that the biggest thing is that they are loved, and that if they have anything that has gone wrong, please come talk to us, because we don't ever want to get this phone call again. The big thing is just keep talking about it. We cannot create this thing to become a taboo. If we keep talking about it, if we keep recognizing that there is a problem, we can start to make progress on this. The stat of 29,099 to 44,000 in 2014, that's staggering.
It's a big jump in suicide in this country, and we're still over that 40,000 mark from the latest numbers that I have seen, which represents something in the range of a 30 to 40% increase in the last two decades. So Pat, let's talk about what you're trying to do positively then. As you said, you know, that's, you've got memories, you've got things you can hold on to that you can still celebrate. Tell me just a little bit more about him first. Superfly.
He was a goofy kid. I think we've finally gotten to the point where we're laughing more than we're actually crying now, because he had so many of those spontaneous stories that just don't make any sense. So what we're trying to do is, our foundation solely benefits the Veterans Outreach Center, and specifically the three houses, the Richards and Otto House and the Priscilla House that they have for their halfway homes. So we've started over the last 3 years doing a golf tournament, and now we're morphing into a little bit more outreach, just smaller events throughout the year. But we specifically go to the Veterans Outreach Center because my brother was active duty Marine, and you know, our family is now a Gold Star family.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM. We're also on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack here for Evan Dawson today. Have a great weekend, everyone. Have a peaceful weekend, and we will talk to you Monday.